I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's a former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So today, let's talk about the wildlife habitat that could be fairly painlessly increased by removing well, instead of me giving it away, you just tell the story.
Okay. The story is this. Agricultural production occupies the majority of land area in the United States, more so than by far than cities, factories, highways, all that. We as a society tend to focus on the cities and the ecological impacts and footprints of cities, which of course extend well outside of the cities because of, you know, reliance on all the natural resources that feed them. But putting that aside, just the land area alone utilized by agriculture is tremendous. Hundreds and hundreds, actually billions, more than a billion acres in the United States. And that land area, a lot of it is marginal for the production of the crops or livestock that's produced there. So, as an example would be, Nevada requires about 200 to 250 acres of land to feed a cow for 1 year. And the production of cattle in a dry state like Nevada has all sorts of ecological costs, trampling of riparian zones, which are the green areas along streams, the dewatering of streams, which there isn't much in the way of streams or water in Nevada, but what there is removed, not for things like Las Vegas sprinklers and fountains, but primarily for hay production, even in a dry state like Nevada. So by contrast, you can grow on 1 acre or 2 acres in Georgia a cow and feed it year-round without having to drain rivers and with a lot less land area. So that's an example of the difference between marginal agriculture and production in perhaps the best areas. And that's not to suggest that producing a cow in Georgia doesn't have ecological impacts. It does. But if you start out with one assumption, which is we're going to grow food somewhere to feed ourselves, then the next question is every place we're growing food the best way to utilize that land? And I would argue it is not. And yet there is a huge movement and bias in this country in favor of agriculture that's not very rational. And for example, a controversy that's occurring right now in California, there is dairy farms that are growing, you know, cows on land in Point Reyes National Seashore. It's a national park unit. And that land was purchased about 40 years ago from the farmers and ranchers that were living out in that area. But they were given a grace period to stay there for a number of years after the purchase. But that has been extended numerous times. And now the Park Service has just come out with a new management plan, planning to allow the dairy farms to exist for another 20 years. And also to shoot the native Tule elk if they compete with the cattle for forage. And this is in a national park. And the surprising thing to me is that there's a tremendous amount of support in the Bay Area for continuing the dairy farms in a national park unit, even though it has many impacts like the pollution of streams there, spread of weeds, etc. So that's the problem I see out there, is that there's a lot of marginal agriculture or agriculture that can be produced, products can be produced elsewhere, and yet we favor the agriculture over wildlife and wildlands, often to the detriment of those values.
Can you give another example of this that you mentioned before about wheat in eastern Montana?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, wheat farming in Montana is another good example. There are literally tens of millions of acres planted to wheat in Montana, and Montana is a dry state and it's cold. And for a variety of reasons, primarily those two, wheat production is not as good as in places that are wetter and have better soils. So wheat farmers in Montana produce about one-third the bushels per acre planted that a farmer in Kansas can produce. And yet they're all selling to the same market. So the marginal producer in Montana is competing against the farmer in Kansas who is, you know, perhaps in a better position to grow wheat. And the problem with growing wheat anywhere or any crop like that, it's a monoculture. So we have tens of millions of acres monoculture wheat, that is, you know, goes to the horizon and provides very little wildlife habitat, if any. And it has a tremendous ecological footprint. So when the wheat is harvested, the ground is bare and you get a lot of soil and wind erosion, losing topsoil. You, of course, most of these crops are drenched with fertilizers and pesticides, which get into the waterways and pollute water. And as I said, the wheat fields have replaced native vegetation in most of Montana anyway. A lot of that native vegetation was either native grasslands or sagebrush steppe, which are critical wildlife habitat for all sorts of species that are now displaced by that agricultural production. And the farmers there, the wheat farmers, in most years actually don't make a profit. They survive on government subsidies. In some years, over half of their income comes from federal farm subsidies. And that allows them to survive through the lean years until they have a good year or two, and then they are able to, you know, purchase new tractors and all that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, all that time, even in the lean years, they're selling the wheat they do produce into the market, and that's competing with the farmers in other places. And that has contributed to a loss of, you know, a tremendous amount of habitat for wildlife. For example, in eastern Montana, one of the species that's having problems is sage grouse, because so much of the sagebrush country was plowed up to plant for wheat. And the irony I see, again, getting back to this bias for agriculture, I'll travel with people in various places in Montana, other places in the West, where there are these monocultures of hay or wheat or corn or whatever, and they'll ignore that. We'll go for miles through all that, and then they'll see like a subdivision out in the middle of nowhere, and they'll say, God, that place is ruining all the wildlife habitat. And the irony is the subdivision probably has more wildlife habitat than the wheat field or the hay field, due to the fact that most subdivisions have landscaping and, you know, plant trees and shrubs and so forth. So they have at least a minimal amount of wildlife habitat. I noticed this years ago. I was thinking about this, my yard in Livingston, Montana. I used to have about four or five different bird species nesting in it every year. And, you know, lots of other species coming through. And then I thought, well, you know, in just the block I live on, gosh, there must be several dozen nesting birds just in the homes in that block. And then I was thinking, compared to a hayfield of the same size, there wouldn't be any nesting birds probably, and certainly not in the wheat field. And so people, they just focus on the development. And I'm not trying to say development is good by any means, but that we have to take a more honest and rational approach towards agriculture. Yet around the West, a lot of land trusts and so forth focus on preserving wild wheat fields or hay fields or agricultural fields, and the whole premise is that it's good for wildlife, when in fact, for the most part, it is not good for wildlife. And especially if it's marginal, without the subsidies, a lot of that land would go up for sale, and the idea that it would all become subdivisions is also a farce, because there's only so much demand for new housing tracts. In most places, if there is a demand, it's already being subdivided. And that gets to another point, which is people believe that by subsidizing marginal agriculture, somehow they're going to preserve land and keep it from being developed into cities and highways and that sort of thing. And the irony there is, if that strategy was effective, we wouldn't have rural sprawl anyplace. Think of California, which is the extreme example. The farmland in California is some of the most valuable in the country. And if agriculture would prevent the expansion of cities and sprawl, well, you wouldn't have L.A. or Sacramento or any of those other cities that have expanded greatly beyond their initial boundaries. And the reason is in any kind of price war, the agricultural land is a low value land use compared to, developing it with a city or houses or anything like that. Not suggesting that necessarily that that's a better land use. I am just simply saying that in the economics of things, agricultural land uses do not have an ability to stop development in and on of themselves. And if that's your conservation strategy, you better rethink it, because it hasn't worked very well anywhere.
I'm thinking a couple things. One is, when I read mystery novels that were written in the 20s and 30s in L.A., it's interesting how it's a pretty short drive from the detective's office out to orange orchards. And that's just making your point that now you've got to drive a long ways to get to, from downtown Los Angeles to get to agriculture. And then the other point is, I used to be a commercial beekeeper. I don't know if you know that, back in my 20s and 30s. And there's a saying among beekeepers, which is, you get 90% of your honey from 10% of the land. And what that really meant was, you get 90% of your honey from, like if your bees are near an alfalfa field, you get it from the fence rows. And the rest of it is pretty useless, because they cut it at early bloom. And I'm guessing, I think that beekeeper statement might be a similar thing. As things currently stand, the only wildlife you're going to see in a wheat field is going to be, you know, three bunnies who can live along the fence row.
Well, that's true. And you also have the fact that, occasionally a deer or something like that will be out in a hay field during a time. But you also have to ask what wildlife is, I don't want to say important, but in need of habitat. There are certain species like white-tailed deer that are pretty adaptable and can live in a lot of places. They are less impacted. I'm not saying they're not impacted somewhat, but less impacted by something like a hayfield than maybe pygmy rabbits that used to live in the sagebrush that was there before they cut all the sagebrush down to make the hayfield. So what wildlife utilizes an area or doesn't utilize an area is also an important question to ask yourself. And one of the things that I have seen, just to use another example of how if the marginal agriculture were not subsidized and continued to have the public support, a good example is what happened in New England about 100 years ago or more. Back in the 1840s and 50s, the single biggest agricultural production in Vermont was sheep. A lot of the hills in Vermont were denuded to make pasture for sheep. And then on top of that, you had logging paper production and other things. So that at one point, about 85% of Vermont was totally deforested. And then over time, a lot of those hill farms in particular were abandoned because there were better places to raise sheep than on steep hillsides in Vermont. And other crops in Vermont are pretty marginal because of the cold and so forth. So, you couldn't grow corn there and compete with, say, Indiana or Iowa. So over time, a lot of the farms were abandoned, and during that time period, the trees started to grow back, and a lot of wildlife restored itself. At one time, there weren't even white-tailed deer in Vermont, and no moose, no marten, Beaver were extinct. There were all sorts of species that had been wiped out. Well, as the forest came back, a lot of these species started to filter back into the state. And today there's thousands of moose. There's, you know, God knows how many white-tailed deer. There's black bear, beaver, marten, fisher. And even a year or two ago, a lynx was sighted in the state. So, this is an example of what happens when some of that marginal agriculture, is allowed to self-restore, or, you know, you can also help it along at times. But the point was, is back 150 years ago, there weren't things like agricultural subsidies. So those farmers didn't have a choice. If they were growing sheep, and you could grow it cheaper in, you know, some place like California or Oregon or wherever, Wyoming, then they had to give up the sheep raising. Today, though, we maintain a lot of this marginal agriculture with all sorts of federal subsidies, and so they don't have the same economic, factors that would determine whether it was really made sense to be raising whatever it is, that product, in any particular place.
So you and I have talked before, and there a lot of environmentalists have talked about the harmful effects of public lands grazing in the West. And I remember reading, I think it was in either one of your books, or it was also, it might have been in Lynn Jacobs' book, about what percentage of the beef in the United States is actually raised on public lands in the West. And do you happen to know the number off the top of your head? I remember it was really small, but I don't want to say it if you know it, because I might get it wrong.
Well, I do know it. And the way you have to talk about it is the forage produced off of public lands, because, unlike private lands, the public lands are grazed by varying amounts of time, depending upon where you are. Places like Arizona, a lot of the ranchers are on the public land year-round, but up in Montana, because it's snowy mountains country, they might only graze it 2 months of the year. So it's the forage that's produced, and that number is about 3% if you count all the state and federal lands that are leased for livestock grazing in the entire West. It would be about 3% of the forage, which, you know, basically is nothing.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, I mean, this is really making your point that there is this tremendous environmental cost and all this fighting that has been going on about it, and it's a trivial amount of the forage produced for beef. And so not even talking about the, you know, larger issues of beef or anything else. This is just, it's like I always say, people say, if you became president, what would you do? And I always say, well, the first day I would get rid of retractable stadium roofs and golf courses, because it's easy, it's cheap, it's completely, a completely gratuitous, you know, there are easy, the point is that yes, to really stop killing the planet, there have to be serious changes made, but there are some really fairly inexpensive changes that could be made that would have tremendous benefit, which is my understanding of the entire conversation you and I are having today, is that there's some low-hanging fruit, is the phrase.
Yep. Yeah, and here's another point that sort of emphasizes that. I'll give you again a statistic from Montana, since I know it so well. But a gap analysis, that was GAP stands for Geographical Something Project, I can't remember, analysis project or something like that. Anyway, what they do is they use air photos, and they digitize them, and then they can tell you exactly down to practically 30 meter square area what the land use is in any particular place. And then they can aggregate, of course, all those uses and come up with numbers. And one of the surprising factors was when this was done, and this is a while back, probably about 15, 20 years ago, so it's probably changed a little bit, but not much. At that time, 0.17% of Montana was in highways, factories, housing tracts, houses, schools, all the things that we call urban landscapes and rural landscapes that are non-agricultural. So a tiny fraction of the state. And by comparison, just in hay fields and irrigated croplands, which is primarily hay fields in a cold state like Montana, it was 5.5% of the land area was in hay fields. So that's a good example of, if you didn't have agriculture in Montana or you minimized it, you know, most of the state would be virtual wilderness, because that's the large land use across most of the state, particularly in the valleys, is agriculture. And that's surprising to people, because they, again, they notice the subdivisions, they notice the highways and the towns, and it's sort of like they don't see all the agricultural uses. And given another example of that, I recently was driving from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, back up to Montana, and I drove across part of Idaho, where Driggs, Idaho is, and that's Teton County on the east side of the Teton Range. And the local land use group there is celebrating how they have to preserve agriculture in the valley, presumably to preserve the wildlife habitat. And I got some statistics out about it, and these are just sort of rough because I'm just doing this from memory, but it was something like 4,000 acres was in subdivisions, housing tracts, et cetera, in the county. And I believe it was 220,000 acres was in farmland. So again, pointing out the huge disparity, and around there, that's either hay fields or again, potato or wheat fields. So largely biological deserts. And yet the land use, local land trust is trying to, quote, preserve the agriculture for wildlife. And my point being, if that agriculture wasn't there, Teton County would be like being in Grand Teton National Park. And for all the people that are in Grand Teton National Park every summer, it's hell of a lot better for wildlife than Teton County is with its farming and ranching.
Well, you've said this a couple times, and I'm kind of flabbergasted. I can understand wanting to maintain agricultural land because you make money or you make subsidies, and I can understand wanting to maintain agricultural land because of historical, because it was agriculture, you know, 200 years ago, whatever, so as the land trust could do it. But I would disagree, but I can see that rationale. I don't understand how a land trust can rationalize a potato field for wildlife or a wheat field for wildlife. Can you make their best argument? Because that makes no sense to me.
I think the problem is a lot of people associate open space with good wildlife habitat. And agricultural land is considered open space because you can look across it and see the mountains across the way or whatever. But open space is not necessarily good wildlife habitat. Now, good wildlife habitat requires open space, but they're not synonymous. And I think that's the error that's made. And a lot of people that work for these land trusts are as much taken by the agricultural mystique. The, you know, there is a bias in just about everybody that likes bucolic landscapes. I like them, be truthful, except that I see the ecological harm that's been done. But, you know, when you're going along and you see, the average person sees cows out in the green pasture and they just think it looks lovely. And so the land trusts play on that, love of bucolic, rural landscapes. And most people, especially if you're living in a city or a place that's rapidly changing due to growth, as for example, Teton County is adjacent to the Tetons there, then you don't want to see any changes in the land use because it, to your mind, it's a one way negative, procedure. And to some degree, there is. I mean, if you have more urbanization and so forth, you're going to have more congestion. You're going to have other things that are negatives, to the average person living there, air pollution, perhaps, if it was big enough city. All the stuff that comes with urbanization, more crime, etc. So your reaction is to say, if we can stop that by making the agricultural land protected in some way, like, for example, putting a conservation easement on it, We can stop that process or that transformation from a rural landscape to an urbanized landscape and perhaps avoid all those negatives. The problem is it hasn't worked anyplace. So if that's, again, your conservation strategy, you got to rethink it, because it really doesn't prevent that urbanization. The only thing I've seen that works is in Oregon, there is statewide zoning. And in Oregon, if you're going to develop the land for housing or anything else, it has to be within what's called the urban growth boundary. And those urban growth boundaries are set by the cities and or towns. Even the smallest town has to have an urban growth boundary. And all development has to be within that boundary. And that has been pretty effective at reducing the negatives of sprawl in terms of random subdivisions here and there out in the middle of the countryside. It doesn't stop growth, though, however. So, that's a much bigger thing. Then we're talking about doing something about population, which a lot of people don't want to talk about either. But as long as you're going to have population growth, you're going to have towns and cities boundaries expanding. But how they expand and where they expand to can be controlled if you were to implement strong zoning laws.
So there's two directions to go here. One of them is, I did a talk up at some tiny, tiny little town in British Columbia 15 years ago, and one of the things they had me do is go meet with the city council people. And one of the things that they had done in that city, which was pretty extraordinary, was, and I could be messing this up a little bit, but I got the general idea right, that basically any time you wanted to do a new building permit, they didn't want any growth. So anytime there's going to be a new building permit, you can't get one until you take down until some other structure comes down.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty interesting. Anyway, but that's not the real point I want to get to. The real point I want to get to is I want to contrast make this contrast, the American West with Europe. Can you talk about, it's pretty extraordinary how, when I think of Europe, I think of, big cities, I think of the Autobahn, I think of a lot of urbanization. I don't think of wildlands for the most part, but then you'll read stories about wolves making their way back into many countries there, and so can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, much of Europe is doing what I was just talking about. I was in Germany a number of years ago, and if you go to Germany, you'll notice that there'll be farmland, woodlands right up to the edge of a town or a village, and there isn't little houses scattered all over out in the countryside. And I noted that to person I was visiting with. I said, how do you prevent all these places from having subdivisions all over? He said, well, we have the whole country is zoned, and if it's zoned for agriculture or forestry or whatever, you can't build new houses there. And I said, well, that's remarkable. How did you pass that? And this guy looked at me. He said, well, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? He couldn't imagine a situation without that. And the other thing that's happening in Europe is the same thing that's happening in a lot of parts of our country, actually, which is a gradual abandonment of rural areas for a whole host of reasons. But as some of that, and usually the abandonment has to do with marginal agriculture being abandoned, as that has happened, the opportunities for wildlife to restore themselves has occurred. So there are now grizzly bears in the, Austrian Alps. There are wolves, as you noted, in many parts of Europe now, Germany and
the Netherlands,
France,
were crying out loud.
Yes, right. Places that they haven't been seen in hundreds of years. And lynx are expanding, European lynx, and so forth. So this sort of restoration, and a lot of it is just passive restoration, like what happened in New England, where when those lands were abandoned and people weren't actively utilizing them anymore, then they became suitable for wildlife to recolonize, so to speak. Just to kind of make a point, another point earlier that's comparison to this, but think about, and I'm sure you've done this, driven the I-5 corridor from the Oregon border down towards Sacramento in California through Central Valley. If you do that at night, you will see very few lights. I mean, most of what's on either side of that interstate is agricultural fields. It's not cities. There's not a lot of people living in the Central Valley north of Sacramento, except for the town of Redding and a few other towns up that way. And so you could easily imagine, if a lot of that, agricultural production were to be abandoned, how it would be recolonized by many native species, and probably, in fact, wolves again, because they are moving back into California from Oregon. So it's not as far-fetched as someone might believe. There's a lot of the country, even in a densely populated state like California, that really is largely unpopulated. One of the interesting things I noted when I was doing one of my books is that Northern California, and I'm defining it as north of Santa Rosa up to the Oregon border, and if you drew a line across north of Sacramento and so forth, actually has a much lower population density than western Montana. You've got towns like Missoula, Bozeman, Kalispell, Great Falls, Helena, all that. There's, other than Redding, there's not a large town in that whole area of California. And the and so if western Montana can support grizzly bears and wolves and big elk herds, etc., there's actually no reason I can see for why those species could not be supported in that part of California, but for the intensive agricultural use of Central Valley and other areas.
So to be really clear and explicit about what you're saying, mm-hmm. you're arguing for a very low cost, high return, in terms of low cost to economic production, high return in terms of ecological restoration, approach to those particular lands. Because, I just want to make this really clear, because the wheat farming, for example, is pretty marginal, or the cattle grazing is marginal compared to Georgia, and so it's fairly low cost for that, and then it's a high return also because the low cost was, in a lot of cases, all you have to do is stop causing the harm. And, you know, I interviewed Michael Kellett a while ago, and he brought up the term afforestation as opposed to reforestation, mm-hmm. where you go in and you replant and you do everything you can. Afforestation is you go, huh, I wonder what the forest would want to do, and you leave it aside, and then the forest returns on its own. So what you're right. suggesting really is a fairly cheap, in terms of macroeconomics, I mean, of right. course, the individual farmers and ranchers are going to fight hard unless they get subsidies to get out. I'm just rambling now. So just go from there.
Well, just to follow up on that, I'll give you an example. The Great Plains is probably one of the best opportunities we have for some sort of restoration like this, passive restoration, because a lot of the Great Plains is marginal for things like wheat production and so forth, particularly in the drier portions of it in eastern Montana and parts of Wyoming, et cetera. And that land, a lot of the farmers in that area are on what's called a conservation reserve program. This is just one of the government subsidies. And what happens with that program, CRP, is that if a farmer agrees to take his wheat field out of production and put it into grass, and it doesn't even have to be native grass, then the government will pay him X amount of dollars per acre per year for a 10-year period. And the whole purpose is partly justified on reducing soil losses and water pollution from sedimentation, sediments getting into the water. And also it is justified as a way to make more wildlife habitat, although the whole system really is pretty marginal for wildlife the way it's run right now. But the point being is that over the period of the 10-year lease, in a lot of parts of eastern Montana, we pay more to lease the land for 10 years if you look at the cumulative cost of the 10-year lease, then you could buy the land outright because it's very cheap. In a lot of places there, you can buy $100 an acre for farmland in the more marginal areas if you're buying in large quantities. And the point being that we're paying more for this land through this one subsidy than it's really worth in terms of its ability to produce a crop. And the if that same amount of money were just directed towards buying the land outright and then making it public land, we'd be far better off. And the interesting thing is a lot of the what is the BLM land and the national grasslands in places like eastern Montana, North Dakota, and other states in that Great Plains Belt in Colorado were lands that were abandoned back in the 1920s and 30s during the Dust Bowl days. And back then they didn't have all these subsidies, so just got abandoned. And the federal government was the buyer of last resort because nobody else wanted to buy marginal crop land that you couldn't, you know, couldn't make money on. And so these lands were acquired, and that's how we got those public lands in states like in places like eastern Montana and you know, grasslands in Colorado, et cetera. And so it shows you what's possible. And those lands that are BLM or national grasslands are far better for wildlife than the farmland that they originally were prior to the acquisition by the federal government. So I see an opportunity for huge restoration. At one point, this is, again, going back a number of years, I calculated that for – I kind of added up all the larger crop subsidies that wheat farmers were getting in eastern Montana at the time, and took that total amount of money and figured out at the current rate of farmland cost in eastern Montana, how much land could you buy? Well, I calculated that a 10 years worth of farm subsidies would have been able to, you would have been able to purchase 30 million acres in eastern Montana at the going rate of land at that time. 30 million acres. That's the size of New York State. I mean, that could have been acquired and put back into wildlife production instead of agricultural production. And it's important to note, as I said earlier, that a lot of this agricultural production that's marginal doesn't contribute that much to the overall food resources in this country. For one thing, we can, you'd be amazed how little land it takes to grow a lot of things that we consume. But the point being that, you know, an acre of growing corn in the Corn Belt in like Illinois will produce way more corn per bushel than irrigated cornfield in some place like North Dakota. And so the loss of, say, you know, irrigated cornfield in North Dakota from the crop production for the country would hardly be felt at all, especially since most of our corn is fed to livestock anyway. So that's another issue.
So we have about 10 minutes left, and there's a couple questions I want to ask. And one of them is, can you walk us through – I'm going to ask both questions, and you can do whatever you want with them. The first question is, can you walk us through – let's say that there's 20,000 acres in eastern Montana that was purchased, and currently it's half in wheat, half in alfalfa, and – walk us through what the next 20 years might look like if that land were purchased and then converted to wildlife use. And the second question is going to be, and you can do these whatever order you want, if they made you, you know, head of, they develop a new position for you at the federal level, which is the Department of Agriculture, semicolon, marginal lands. And what policies would you put in place? I suspect that they're what you just said about converting from subsidies to buying, but I want to be explicit about what policies you would actually put in place having to do with marginal agricultural lands.
Well, one of the first things I would do if I had that kind of control is to do a full cost accounting of the ecological costs of all the agricultural production. Because not only are these lands marginal economically, they generally, the more marginal land is for production, the more, the higher the environmental costs associated with that production. So for example, just to make it real, if you're growing cows in the Nevada desert, you have to have irrigated hay fields to sustain the cows because they can't get enough food just going wandering around out in the arid lands there for miles and miles trying to find a grass here and there. So you would put into that cost the dewatering of streams and the groundwater pumping that it drying up springs. You would put in to that cost equation the loss of riparian areas, which are critical wildlife habitat in a dry area like Nevada, because all the wildlife focuses on the places that have water. You would put in the competition with native species. You know, if the cows are eating the grass, that's grass that, you know, desert tortoise and jackrabbits don't get to eat. You would throw in perhaps the diseases transmitted to wildlife. And if you put in all that kind of stuff, it becomes even more marginal because that's a cost to society. All those things are costs that we either have to live with or we have to try to rectify by, you know, spending money bringing back endangered species that are endangered because of that agricultural production. So articulating the real cost is the first thing. And then seeing the second thing would be what kinds of subsidies sustain that agriculture, either because we ignore the environmental costs and then we also prop them up with, you know, cold hard cash. And then that would give you a picture of what lands would be the best to, you know, start with in terms of trying to do a restoration, because they would be the ones that you would that are in most need of having restoration and have the least contribution of actual food production to the country, and would have and generally, because they're marginal, they're also not very expensive lands to acquire if you were going to choose to acquire them. So that's, I guess, how I would start the whole equation out, is doing a cost accounting and assessment. And you could probably do this on a pretty broad range and focus in on different, you know, parts of the country that offer you opportunities.
And then if you were, again, you're in charge of this, are you going to start with voluntary sales? Or are you going to move to eminent domain pretty quickly? Or not at all?
Well, you know, in some ways, if you eliminated the subsidies, a lot of these guys would be anxious to sell because they wouldn't be able to maintain their businesses. And if you said, you know, we're not going to give you the Conservation Reserve Program anymore, and we're not going to give you, you know, the Emergency Livestock Program anymore, and we're not going to do, you know, the Drought Relief Program anymore, and so forth and so on, if you eliminated all those programs, then they would be, you know, they would be happy to sell to the federal government or anybody else who would be willing to buy their operations at that point. And so I do not think that you'd have to use eminent domain. Although, you know, I do want to make the point that we think nothing about using eminent domain to build highways or reservoirs, right, or anything else, and why we shouldn't use eminent domain to restore wildlife habitat. You know, I don't see why there's any difference when we're quite willing to take away people's private property with payment, of course, but for public good, for all these other destructive uses of the land.
And so let's walk through. We have 5 minutes left. Let's walk through. Let's walk through some land in Oregon. I'm sorry, in Eastern Oregon Works or Eastern Montana, whatever. You pick it. You pick an example of, let's do 10,000 acres, 5,000 of which are wheat, 5,000 of which are alfalfa, and those are acquired for nature habitat, for wildlife habitat, and what happens over the next 10 years to that land? How does so they stop plowing. They stop doing all those things. What happens? Walk us through the nature doing all the work or humans doing some of the work too. Walk us through the restoration.
Well, that's your choice. You could do passive restoration just kind of by leaving it alone and letting, you know, natural processes take over, that could be a long-term project as a result. Or you could speed it up a little bit by, you know, in a lot of cases, like if you're talking about a wheat field, like you, we use it as an example, there are often tens of thousands of acres planted to wheat in any particular area. Therefore, the native seed sources are pretty much gone for, you know, whether it's native grasses or sagebrush and other shrubs that would otherwise exist in that area. So one way you could speed up the process, of course, is by doing some active planting, replanting of some of those native plants to sort of inoculate, you might say, that wheat field or that alfalfa field with native species that over time would gradually, in most cases, outcompete those exotics. And the reason they would is simply that the exotics are not usually as well adapted to that particular climate and soil and so forth as the native species were. And over time, the native species would probably, in all likelihood, take over. But it could be a very long process. An example I can give you, I know that part of what is now Yellowstone Park near Gardner, Montana, was acquired, I believe, in the 1930s, and it was irrigated something, hay fields or something like that. I'm not quite sure what it was, but it was irrigated cropland. And the Park Service just acquired it and left it alone. And a lot of that is still largely kind of weedy species, even though we're talking, you know, almost 70, 80 years passage of time. And there was no active restoration. And part of the problem was there was the native species seed sources were eliminated over such a large area that it's hard for them to recolonize. And it also, in the most arid part of Yellowstone Park, it gets only 9 inches of precipitation a year there. And so it's very dry to begin with. So, you know, not easy for any plant to get established. They only get established, you know, they might only have a good seed year every 10 or 20 years. And so, it, you know, in 100 years, you might only have 5 times when you got any good seed production at all. So that's the problem you're up against. So, I mean, you know, in moister places, you know, you get your natives back a lot sooner. That's what happened in New England forests. It's moist, it rains. There was a sufficient source of seeds in the areas around the abandoned farmland, and quickly the native trees came back in. So, you know, I guess it would just be a matter of time how much money and, you know, how quickly you wanted to see results. But I could tell you that in most cases, if you give it an adequate amount of time, it would be improved for wildlife over what the agricultural fields were, and with time get better.
That's another thing that kills me about all this, is that as long as you're going to subsidize stuff, it's like the world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized to a greater value than the entire value of their catch. Mm-hmm. And it's if you're going to just dump the money out, I mean, why don't, if we're going to dump money to make stuff that is to destroy the land, why don't we just hand out the same amount of money and put the same people to work, and they can use the same bulldozers even, and the same heavy equipment to restore. This is something that boggles my mind.
Well, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right, and in certain, especially in other issues that we're not talking about today, but stuff like forest restoration, you know, you could justify it just in the carbon sequestration that would happen, and there's opportunities there to restore forests in a lot of places that have been heavily logged in the past, and the cost per acre in a lot of cases would be justified just on the carbon storage that you would get as a result.
I would think the same would be true for grasslands, because they can restore a tremendous amount, or they can sequester a tremendous amount of carbon.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got to, you know, there's a whole lot of things that are missing. You know, I was talking about seeds, but, you know, also with all these native plants, there's insects and other things that are all grow in association. And a lot of times all those things have been wiped out. And, so If their place has been used for agriculture for many years with the pesticides and the fertilizers being dumped on it, I mean, you basically have sterilized the soils in a lot of cases. So it's going to take a while to, you know, build up the mycorrhizal fungi and bacteria in the soil and so forth. But yes, over time, grassland restoration makes a lot of sense too. And certainly, getting the native wildlife back on those lands and having the hydrological cycles restored, the lowering the soil losses and the sedimentation in rivers, and so you get less pollution. I mean, you start adding all that up, and it's worth a lot. That's the irony, is all this land restored is worth a lot more than most of the agricultural production that's occurring on it.
Well, that's the story of basically all environmental destruction. This is all just insane. Is there anything, we've got like 1 minute, is there anything else you want to say about this incredibly important topic of low-hanging environmental fruit?
Well, again, just that I would challenge anybody who thinks, preserving agriculture for wildlife and wildlands, I mean, and there's always exceptions where there's a strategic parcel or whatever, but go drive across, like the Gallatin Valley in Montana is a good example. People are all worried about the impacts of subdivisions there, but really start looking to see how much land is in wheat or hay fields, and you'll see way, 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 way more land is in the agricultural production, and most of that's a biological desert. And you have to look at it that way.
As a poster I saw 25 years ago that had, I think, of several pictures. One of them was of a Doug fir tree plantation in Oregon. One of them was a cornfield. One of them was a wheat field. And I don't know what the other one was. And it said, all these are biological deserts.
Yep.
We need to see them that way.
Yep, exactly. I can't tell you. I just drove back to Oregon from Montana last week and crossed southern Idaho at the edge of the mountains. It's just alfalfa fields and hay fields, and there's nobody out there. I mean, the population, human population, the towns, have 50 people in them for hundreds of miles, and yet there's all these fields. If you want to see what the impact is, the agriculture is by far and away the biggest impact there. So you just got to start looking at the impacts.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for all of your incredible work in the world, and thank you for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.